Mind that is decentering on what you might expect, in the sense that, you know, most of the historiography that's mostly done, and I've certainly been in this groove, it's, you know, what historians think about what other historians are doing. These papers address much more broad social, political issues to give a fix on why people choose the topics they choose, or how they, you know, how opportunities open up. So I found reading them revelatory and instrumental, as a matter of fact. So Scott Johnson, we're going to follow the program. I'm going to introduce each one at a time, and I'm going to be brief with the introductions. So Scott earned his PhD in history from the CUNY. His dissertation is on the French Revolution, the French Algerian War. He has listed in his CV a few of his recent publications. Most strikingly to me, I want to hear more about it, excuse the pronunciation, Maud Manoni and Pierre Aguilenier on Mental Illness and Disability, Parents at the Border Between Society and Childhood, published in Psychoanalysis and History. And he has a second one forthcoming in Psychoanalysis and History. I bet no one else can say that at the conference. So welcome to everybody. And Scott, you're up.
Good morning. Where are we? There we go. So actually, I'm going to turn the lights down. So this paper is about a strand in French military theory developed in the 1950s within the framework of Revolutionary War that today military strategists would label counterinsurgency theory or COIN. A great deal of excellent work has been written on the ways these theories aided and abetted the brutality of French military policy at the end of empire, their Cold War logics, as well as a continuing legacy of these theories, especially in relation to current U.S. military strategy. However, this morning, I'd like to focus on an often neglected aspect of these theories' development, their historical orientation, and suggest that when theorists of Revolutionary War were preoccupied with fighting Algerian revolutionaries, they were doing so with the French Revolution of 1789 in mind. Specifically, I'd like to focus on the connection to the French Revolution in two elements of this theory. One, the military's superficial engagement with the military theorist Clausewitz. Second, the counterintuitive use of the Russian propagandist Serge Chakotin. Other scholars, such as Peter Perret and Marnia Lazreg, and over a long continuity from the 60s to the present, have noted the continuities between this particular counter-revolutionary viewpoint and the longer counter-revolutionary tradition in France. However, these analyses are often based on sociological observations about the preponderance of integrist Catholics in the French officer corps, or a sense of betrayal with regard to de Gaulle's shift to withdrawing from Algeria. While these are salient points, I would like us to take seriously the tangibility of the French Revolution and Algerian decolonization, and see the ways understandings of the French Revolution were present from the very genesis of Revolutionary War theory. My research in general deals with the intersections of the history of the French Revolution and its connections with Algerian decolonization. The French Revolution was a dominant reference in the 50s and 60s for deciphering both the fate of metropolitan French Republic and interpreting Algerian nationalist demands for independence. Historians debating the perils of anachronism pointed to the French Revolution as a paradigm for deciphering the present, or saying it shouldn't be. Developmentalist discourse in the social sciences and anti-colonialist political theorists used the revolution as a diagnostic for politically modern change. Public debates concerning the course of the war used the revolution as a rhetorical tool to support positions on the use of torture, the legitimacy of terrorism, the collapse of the Fourth Republic, and Third Worldist direct action on behalf of the FLN. Indeed, wherever people and events from 1954 to 1962 suggested the revolution was in the air, they very often meant the revolution begun in 1789. For instance, this appeared clearly in the May 1958 crisis that brought down the Fourth Republic, both in the metropole and in Algeria. and direct action from militant partisans of French Algeria drew on this revolutionary imaginary as well, all the way through the week of the barricades in 1960, and calls to support the right-wing Secret Army Organization, or OAS, from 1961 to 1962. The view that the Republic was in danger and needed to draw from its deep patriotic past to regain control of Algeria also existed within the ranks of the military itself. When the Minister of the Armed Forces, Max Lejeune, for instance, began drastically increasing the number of soldiers in Algeria, he named the directive Operation Valmy. What France needed most of all, he reasoned, was a citizen army ready to defend the territorial integrity of the Republic, as had happened at the Battle of Valmy in 1792. Whereas critics of the government's actions in Algeria would draw from the revolution in order to critique the actions of the nation from within, Lejeune continued to see the revolution by way of France's tradition of citizen defense and the civilizing mission. Similarly, General Massu echoed the sentiment when he called on his fellow paratroopers in Algeria to take power in their own hands and call for a new government with Charles de Gaulle at its head, evoking, quote, the great ideas of generous France, those ideas that since 1789 have shaken the world and would triumph in Algeria. By the end of the war in Indochina, the status of revolutions in the Cold War had been at the forefront of French military personnel's concerns. Mao Zedong's success in China and the eventual loss of Indochina suggested to many strategists that international communism was an existential threat. And this is not just the case for France. The apparently rapid-fire chain of interventions and standoffs throughout Europe and Asia convinced theorists they had to think of these geopolitical events as inherently connected. The earliest theorists of Revolutionary War, Colonels Charles Lachois and Lionel-Max Chassin, extrapolated this military strategy that Mao claimed was his key to success in China, and then mapped it onto later military challenges to Western power, looking to experiences in the ongoing war over Indochina to verify their hypotheses. This new war, variously called Revolutionary War, Subversive War, or Rotten War, was defined by its use of partisan and guerrilla tactics combined with psychological warfare. In their view, this war was conducted over five distinct vectors that ranged from initial propaganda efforts to political organization and then all-out warfare, both physical and psychological. Central to the combat against subversion was the belief that the army needed to take on new political and social roles to strengthen and inoculate French society against subversive infiltration, ultimately stemming from the Kremlin through its international subversive networks. The military could no longer afford to be the silent giants at the disposal of civilian bureaucrats in their reasoning. Otherwise, French society could easily be supplanted. And Chassin claimed that this had happened in previously, in his words, decadent civilizations. According to General Ayard, in a 40-plus page dossier on the, quote, truths concerning the Algerian affair, quote, it is not out of the question to presume that, in the thinking of the Kremlin master, the process of contamination would not stop at the whole of the Black Continent, but also cross the Atlantic and infiltrate the Americas. In practice, this approach meant many of the programs that historians have come to see as the hallmarks of military campaigns in Algeria, managing potentially rebellious Muslim populations, whether in the Kasbah of Algiers or in the rural countryside, counter-terror campaigns employing emergency powers, extrajudicial executions, and torture. Various forms of social services outreach, ranging from agricultural development to educational programs, youth sports, and medical treatment. Most important of all, though, was the effective use of political propaganda aimed at winning, quote, the hearts and minds of the Muslim population, communicating the army's strategic framework to the partisans of French Algeria. Indeed, in the weeks leading up to the May 13, 1958 putsch in Algiers, Algerian newspapers were flooded with articles explaining the theory of revolutionary and subversive warfare. This is true in these two newspaper articles. You can look at any Algerian newspaper in the weeks leading up, and they're all over the place. By the end of 1958, there were even book-length studies developing the topic for the general French public, including an article in PUF's Cossège series, and right-wing Catholic publications with connections to the military also publicized these theories. To further publicity and propaganda operations, the military transformed their psychological bureau into the Fifth Bureau in 1957, with accompanying training centers in places like Arzew in the northeast of Oran, and that's one of a series of centers. One might object that much of this violence and the discourse surrounding it in Algeria was simply old wine in new bottles. As far as the military tactics employed, there's a striking continuity with the approaches developed by people like Bougeot and Lyoté, including the control of large spaces through the ink stain approach, the focus on implementing social policies and population management. Similarly, efforts to manage and control rebellious North African places predated the war in Algeria. However, the differences in how military officials objectified their violence and justified their theories to each other and the public matters quite a bit. It says what the military thought they were doing and helps us gauge why sectors of the military were in nearly constant states of crisis throughout the war. So even though the military may have remained Bougeauds and Lyotés in the battlefield, in the agora they were now presenting themselves as Clausewitzes and Chapoutins. Over and over in their commentaries, Revolutionary War theorists returned to the German theorist Karl von Clausewitz and his work on war as a point of reference. While Clausewitz's studies, so to speak, had declined before the Second World War, in the post-war period, his popularity resurged. Typically, this is understood as a reaction to the new threat of atomic warfare and the influential analyses of Raymond Aron. But equally important was the emphasis that Lenin and Mao themselves had placed on the connection Clausewitz made between warfare and political action, and Clausewitz's diagnosis that warfare had fundamentally changed as a result of the French Revolution. Both of these elements appeared repeatedly in the development of revolutionary war theory. On the issue of political action, a common refrain was that warfare was not only an extension of politics, but that also the inverse was true in modern wars. Political action was a vital element to successful military strategy. On the issue of the French Revolution, Clausewitz's analysis of partisan warfare in Napoleonic Europe and their origin in the Revolution's wars were a constant touchstone. To take just one example, Colonel Louis Bertaille, when explaining Clausewitz's relevance for understanding revolutionary wars, claimed that, quote, when the French Revolution designated its political objective as freeing subversive or subservient peoples, destroying monarchical governments and their aristocratic institutions, by applying Danton's formula, war in the chateau, peace in the cottages, it substituted for a national war of defense, an aggressive ideological war. This tendency has only been amplified. So that's at the beginning of the book, framing it, and at the very end, or close to the end, he then continues, internal subversion is for a long time employed as a prologue to combat. During the Revolution's wars, France's governments, under the Committee of Public Safety, then the Directory, made a number of attempts at psychological warfare through their agents' propaganda directed against states with liberal factions. From Clausewitz, these theories drew the lesson of the importance of political messaging as a complement to traditional military action. The form and technique of this messaging would be drawn from the Russian theorist Serge Chapoutin. For purposes of time, I won't go into details about Chapoutin's life, but would be happy to discuss them in discussion, and it's fascinating. Initially published in 1939, Chapoutin's major work was expanded and revised for a 1952 edition. This study was The Rape of the Masses by Political Propaganda, and it drew on his own brand of Pavlovian psychology, personal experience, what we can see as 2 decades of field work resisting both Bolshevik propaganda and then Nazi propaganda, and historical research to sketch his theory of, quote, psychic rape, the idea that successful propaganda has the power to influence large masses of people based on manipulating pre-rational conditioned reflexes, or what he termed the 4 basic pulsions. And so in his view, it's a combative pulsion, a nutritive pulsion, a sexual pulsion, and a parental pulsion. And then from these, you get the whole chart of all the different types of action you can derive. For our purposes today, I only wish to mention that on top of his work with Pavlov, Chapoutin also engaged with early psychoanalysis, as well as French theorists of crowd psychology, Gabriel Tarde and Gustave Le Bon. This makes for eclectic reading to 21st century readers, I would probably argue for 1930s readers, but had some interesting consequences for French military audiences. When it came to Chapoutin's historical sensibility, his points of reference, furthermore, turned out to be easily misunderstood. From the outset, Chapoutin identified himself as an heir of Enlightenment ideals, of progress leading to greater material and social equality. In political terms, this meant distinguishing between true revolutionary and counter-revolutionary tendencies. On the side of progressive revolutions, Chapoutin placed the French, Russian, and Chinese revolutions. on the side of reactionary counter-revolution, he placed Hitler and Mussolini. Anticipating his audience's possible reactions, he further explained that of course we could locate figures like a Robespierre or Lenin who appeared to seize control of revolutionary impulses, but unlike a Hitler or Mussolini, they were only part of a larger popular manifestation of the march toward progress. The goal of his work was to understand the psychological and physiological mechanisms employed by counter-revolutionary forces like fascism in order to ensure future progress could occur. Now, after laying out his theory of the behavioral dynamics of political propaganda, Chakotin examined historical episodes in which this propaganda was successfully put into practice, from examples including nascent propaganda from the ancient world and Middle Ages to modern examples from the French Revolution, Russian Revolution, and Hitler's Germany. In this historical overview, the French Revolution stands out as the first truly modern use of political propaganda. Relying on Ernst Lewiste and Hippolyte Taine, he argued that during the French Revolution, quote, a true explosion of agitation and propaganda can be seen, one that takes on an equally intense and violent allure in which the principle of battle or the first pulsion, as we've designated it, becomes the most dominant and effective. This was achieved through the use of slogans, new terminology, imagery, anthems, public demonstrations and festivals, but above all, the prime mover of propaganda, the masses' constant threat of physical force. Given Chakotin's favorable view of the French Revolution and his view that French, Russian, and Chinese revolutions were fundamentally omens of progress despite their problems, why exactly did French military theorists so eagerly attempt to adapt his theories? As Neil McMaster has observed, if Revolutionary War theorists had actually read Chakotin carefully, they would have seen his commitment to social democracy and Enlightenment ideals of national self-determination, fraternity, equality, etc. Indeed, Chakotin was a pacifist and against all forms of military intervention and social manipulation. His work was intended as a diagnostic device and a warning, not a how-to manual. However, we can identify a number of elements that made Chakotin's theories resonate with military theorists. First of all, his ideas were not the first framework for assessing problems of crowd control in the French army. Aside from earlier theorists of colonial population management, the prime examples being Lyautey and Gallieni, the power of, quote, the crowd as a political force was a ubiquitous political bogeyman since the revolution. When Chakotin engaged with the theories of Gustave Le Bon and Gabriel Tard, the former's works having been part of French officer training since the 1930s, military theorists were primed to pick up what he was putting down, so to speak, at least in their minds. Often, it seems, military theorists appeared to see more confirmation than critique of Le Bon's anti-revolutionary sentiments in Chakotin's work. Second, for the ultra-conservative members of the officer corps, they could see the outlines of a history of ideological subversion since the French Revolution, one whose declension narrative matched the changes in modern warfare, diagnosed by Clausewitz and the legacy of the French Revolution, found in center-right newspapers. And you see this in the Metropole from Le Figaro and Combat, to right-wing journals like Pierre Boutang's La Nation Française, or Jean Lucet's Verbe, Maurice Bardèche's Défense de l'Occident. And given the Cold War's ideological reductions, they could also see Chakotin as a figure who fought against both Bolshevism and Nazism and ignore his social democratic claims. It is also likely an important matter that Chakotin had relied so heavily on Lewiste and Taine. While Lewiste was by no means counter-revolutionary, I think he was inherently familiar, having authored most common Lycée history texts. He was also less overtly threatening for this reason than, say, if he had relied on a Mathies or a more overtly political historian. I think the same goes double for Taine, who can more easily be read as right-wing. To be sure, we could not assume all members of the officer corps brought into this traditionally counter-revolutionary interpretation of the events. Many, like Max Lejeune, Maurice Schall, or André Zeller, saw the army as republican institutions with its birth in the French Revolution, and this is while they were still rebelling against de Gaulle. But those theorists specifically tied to Revolutionary War theory and practice were overwhelmingly anti-Greek Catholics, sympathetic to overturning the norms and institutions of the Republic. As Colonel Lachois put it in an address to students at one of the training camps in 1957, quote, one does not wage revolutionary war theory with the Code Napoleon. The survival of the French nation meant suspending the principles of the Republic, in his view, not defending them. And by the time it appeared that war in Algeria would finish not with a resounding victory, but with peace with the FLN, it's not altogether unsurprising that many of his theory's proponents would help form the OAS in 1961 and later go overseas to South America and put their skills to use in new theaters of anti-revolutionary struggle. To conclude, I think we can see the insistence on seeing lessons from the French Revolution in revolutionary war theory, including its readings of Clausewitz and Chacotin, and its place in the wider use of the French Revolution in this period, is one of the many ways Algerian decolonization and the French Republic were continually invented and reinvented. As Patricia Owens has argued, quote, there is a homology between social theory and counterinsurgency. Amidst this collapse of France's empire and the potential loss of what was legally an integral part of the Republic, revolutionary war theory sought to stabilize the fabric of the nation. Though all could agree that an understanding of the revolution was necessary for this reinvention, exactly what the revolution meant was not always obvious. One could see the army carrying out the defense of the revolution's legacy, while another could see the army as stemming the historical slip into anarchy, fighting the revolution's spirit embodied by Algerian nationalism. And the very fact that by 1961, partisans of French Algeria, including rebel members of the military, began their own campaign of violent subversion speaks to these fundamental ambiguities. The revolution was everywhere, but exactly who is revolutionary, who fought to defend the Republic versus undermine it, were questions that were harder to pin down. Thank you.